Hello and welcome to another Bruin podcast. The start of the third quarter has been lit up by the performance of Japanese equities, and that performance has been driven by political developments. So we have searched for the Japanese fund manager with the required level of geekery to answer any questions you might have, and several that I suspect you don't, on the obscure world of Japanese democracy. But bear in mind that this is not investment advice. We can't guarantee sources from outside Bruin Dolphin, and tax legislation and allowances can change. Also, please remember that when investing, your capital is at risk. Investment values can increase or decrease because of currency fluctuations, and future performance can differ from that of the past. Now, with that said, let's talk to Jupiter's Dan Carter about what's driving his market's dramatic outperformance. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Bruin podcast. First one back after spending the summer off, and we're delighted to be covering a hot and topical issue, that of Japanese politics, which have become the unexpected story of the markets over the last week or so. And the person we're going to speak to about this is none other than Dan Carter, who's the manager of the Jupiter Japan Income Fund and keeps an understandably close eye on these things. So, Dan, thanks very much for joining us and welcome to the podcast.
Not at all, Guy. Thanks a lot for having me on.
So, as mentioned, we're suddenly all really interested in Japanese politics at the moment. There's a couple of kind of key events coming up. So rather than me talking about them, maybe you could just give us an overview of what this new news is.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a general election coming, basically. And, you know, the LDP won the last election back in October of 2017. So given that we're coming up towards the end of that four-year term, there was always going to be a general election. And up until, I think, quite recently, it had been presumed that that Suga would try and hang on. So that's the current prime minister, Yoshihide Suga, that he would try and hang on. He would win that election, hopefully, and then go on and win the LDP election, so his party election, to be to continue to lead the party and be the prime minister that way. I think what has happened really is that he's been knifed, essentially. That's what's happened. He's been pushed. The party grandees have realised that he was becoming toxic. He was becoming a liability rather than an asset. And although the likelihood of the LDP losing any election is essentially nil, I think they thought that they might lose quite a lot of seats and they might end up having their power in the Diet, that's in the parliament, diluted, really. So it was decided, I think, behind the scenes that he probably, you know, shouldn't fight that election, and that therefore a new leader of the LDP, which is the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan, would have to be sought. So that's what's going to happen. So we're going to get a new leader of the LDP at the back end of this month. They will become the prime minister, and then they will go on and fight a general election sometime after that, you know, certainly before the end of November.
And did they always have a leadership election so soon before a general election? Because that was always likely to happen, wasn't it? But just a bit more of a formality, or had been expected to be more of a formality.
Yeah, the timing of the general election can be called really at any time in the 4 year period of the parliament. So no, you don't have to have a general election you don't have to have a leadership election before the general election, and you can have the general election first, which I think is what Suga initially wanted to do. He wanted to win the election, the general election, and then go on and win the leadership election, because he obviously would at that point have had a mandate from the public. So he'd have walked through the LDP election. It's really only because I think the LDP fear that with Suga they actually wouldn't do very well, that they've decided to roll the dice again and decided to have somebody else to fight that general election. So no, the timing can vary.
Okay, and you said the chances of the LDP losing an election would be very low. I mean, I guess it seems quite confusing to us from the UK, looking at Japanese politics and this remarkable success the LDP have had in getting elected over, I'm not sure what it was, the last 20 years or so. Is there an explanation for why they've got such a sort of stranglehold on Japanese politics?
Yeah, I mean, it's more than that, really. I mean, they were founded in 1955, and they've only not been the party in power for a couple of periods. One just after the global financial crisis, and one in the mid 90s. So they really are the natural party of government for Japan. You know, it's essentially a one party state. Why have they been so dominant? Well, I mean, I think it's a sort of cheesy political phrase, but they're a pretty broad church. You know, there are lots of different policy strands within the LDP. You know, they're generally sort of reasonably conservative. They're more on the sort of conservative side of the spectrum. But because it is actually such a big party with lots of different factions and different policy tribes, you're never entirely sure what you're getting, right? So there's definitely sort of room for manoeuvre within the party for them to continue to take votes. I think that, you know, there are a few other things, but one is, you know, demographics in Japan. The LDP has always been, because it is slightly more on the conservative side, has always done pretty well with older voters. And Japan has quite a lot of old people, as you know, and increasingly so. So I think that's a supportive factor. So I think there are a number of reasons, but one thing that it isn't really is because the LDP is constantly being run by some dazzlingly brilliant politician, some superb policymaker with enormous charisma, because, you know, quite often that hasn't been the case. So it isn't really that. I think that there's quite a lot of default going on.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's certainly the mirror of the stability of the LDP is the extremely short tenures that individual prime ministers seem to experience in Japan. So that's what some sort of a reflection of the amount of disagreement within the party, is it?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that going on. I think there's really been a couple of different kinds of prime minister that you've had.
And just to put it in context, it's about like 2 years average or something, I think I calculated.
It's pretty short. So there have been some longer ones. So if you look, I mean, obviously Abe was in for quite a long time. He did two terms, which added up to really, you know, an awful lot by Japanese standards.
Almost unprecedented, I would.
Yeah, exactly. And before him, well, I said before him, you know, we're talking kind of 15 years ago now, Koizumi was popular and was in power for more than 5 years. So it's not that all of the prime ministers of Japan have had very, very short tenures, but a lot of them have. So if you look over that period, I think there've just been quite a lot of placeholders. There've been some pretty unimpressive LDP placeholders that have really struggled, you know, really struggled to sort of step in after the big beasts of Koizumi and I guess with Suga with Abe as well. We did also have that period where the LDP was out of power. And Japan was run by the DPJ, Democratic Party of Japan. I mean, this is all kind of alphabet soup, but, you know, that was also a group of politicians that were actually just pretty unimpressive. You know, didn't really gather an awful lot of momentum. You know, Hatoyama, Kan, Noda, one after the other. I mean, essentially, it really was a revolving door. The other thing that I think is kind of interesting about Japanese politics that maybe we should touch on, because it might hint at why so many top Japanese politicians, you know, don't appear to be actually all that impressive and don't appear to be able to stick around for all that long, is that Japanese politics is massively dynastic. Most of these guys, and it is almost entirely guys that we're talking about, most of these guys, you know, come from political families. And that isn't necessarily a problem. I mean, you know, Kennedys were a political family, but there is a degree of dilution, I think, that can occur through the generations, and a degree of sort of political power and success which has been achieved by those later generations, which has been much more to do with name than it has been to do with actual political ability.
Inherited rather than earned.
I would argue that there's an element of that, that Japanese politics is not a pure meritocracy. Let's leave it at that, I think. I think that's been the case. Well, we certainly hope that changes, by which I mean that future top politicians, will inevitably come from these dynasties, but let's hope that we get some good ones. Abe is a bit of a counter. I mean, whether you like Abe or not, I mean, he was very successful, and he came from the most dynastic of all Japanese political families. So it's not as if coming from one of those families means that you're necessarily going to be unsuccessful. But I think just the numbers suggest that there's been a few sort of. Yeah, a few guys that have been trading on their name rather than their ability.
Okay, so who? Let's bring this up today. Then, who is in the running to be the new LDP leader and, by implication, prime minister?
Yeah. Okay. So, I think the front runner has to be Taro Kono. It should be said that Taro Kono is also from a famous political family in Japan. So. His father was the president of the LDP and was one of only, I think, a couple that were not the prime minister, because he was the president of the LDP in the mid-90s when the LDP were briefly not in power. So let's hope that if he does take the reins, then he's the exception that proves the rule, and he is actually an extremely competent politician. I think he is very competent. I certainly think he's very charismatic. He's the minister for structural reform in Japan, which means he's essentially Japan's chief red tape cutter. He's also been in charge of the vaccine rollout, but that's more recently, so i.e. for the successful phase of the vaccine rollout rather than the very sluggish beginnings of the vaccine rollout. He was college educated in the US. He was the foreign minister. He's pretty international. He speaks really, really good English. He's very, he's going to be very, very friendly to the market, and particularly to foreign investors. I think foreign investors will love him if he becomes the next prime minister. There's an awful lot to like about him. The issue is, people know relatively little about his policy aspirations, because he just hasn't really been in a position yet where he's had to state them, but he's going to have to quite soon, so we're going to learn an awful lot about that. So I think Taro Kono is the favorite, and he's also probably the most pro-market and will just go down really, really well with international investors. He's not the only guy in the race, though. There are others. So Fumio Kishida has certainly been suggested as a potential successor to Suga. He was one of Suga's big competitors within the party before Suga decided that he wasn't going to run to be the party leader again. So Kishida has always been up against Suga, and I think before Connor was backed by Suga and some other big politicians, I think it was kind of presumed that Kishida would be the guy who would knock Suga off his perch if anybody did. He's a bit of a grayer man than Taro Kono. He's not as interesting, I don't think. He's a sort of powerful backbencher, but he has been in the cabinet before. So, he's a heavyweight. He would also, I think, be pretty market positive. He's been doing some speeches in the last sort of few weeks, talking about how much spending Japanese government needs to do to try and turbocharge the economy to get it out of its post COVID or with COVID torpor. So I think he would be Yeah, no, I think pretty positive for the market, and that's one of the reasons why the market has gone up, because the two most likely people to take over, I think, would probably be sort of pretty good news. But I don't think the news would be as good if it's Kishida as it would be if it's Connor. The final one that I'd mention is, well, potentially Japan's first female prime minister, which is Sanae Takaichi. And she is known as a right winger, and she has been, it has at least been reported that she is supported by Abe himself, because she is also of the nationalist sort of end of Japanese politics. She wants Japan to stand up for herself a little bit more. She wants Japan to be able to project military power overseas, etc. You know, very much of the sort of Abe view. I think she is less likely to take it, but you know, I don't want to stake my reputation on it, because this is politics and anything can happen. She isn't the front runner, but it's certainly plausible that she could take it. The issue is she is, I think, a little bit more divisive because of her more extreme political positioning. And she's also unaffiliated from a factional point of view, which means she might just struggle to garner, she might struggle to garner a bit of support. But you know, if Abe does, you know, publicly back her, and a number of other big heavyweights back her as well, then who knows? You know, maybe she could make it tricky for Connor or Kishida.
Well, so that was one of the things I really wanted to ask you about, these factions in Japanese politics. Like, I don't really feel there's an equivalent of those in UK politics. So maybe you could talk a bit about what this means, these factions.
Yeah, so the factions exist within the LDP. So this is seen as being particular of Japanese politics, but it's actually particular of the LDP within Japan. Right. And you're right, these factions are essentially just groups of parliamentarians, and they tend to support each other. The interesting thing about them, I think, or one of the interesting things about them, is that each of them will have a blend of different policy preferences. So it's not as if these factions map perfectly onto the political spectrum. There's an alternative group of what are called zoku, or policy tribes, really, that straddle various different factions, who tend to vote together on various different issues because politically they are more aligned with one another. So the factions are, I mean, they're certainly not apolitical, but they're not based on policy in the way that you might. They are very much more sort of personal and based upon sort of patrimony. So the reason that they came about was because the LDP was formed, as you guessed by its name, the Liberal Democratic Party, was formed by two parties, the Liberal Party and the Democratic Party, back in 1955. And the five major factions, pretty much, I mean, they've been through various different forms, and they've split and they've merged, etc. But they're essentially based around those two original parties. So the two biggest factions are the Hosoda faction, which came out of the Democratic Party, and then the Aso faction, which came out of the Liberal Party. Or rather, they trace their roots back to the Democratic and the Liberal parties. So all of this is pretty old. As I said, they've been through various different forms over time, but the roots go back to really the founding of the party. The way that these factions exist now and why they're so strong is really just because political support is an important thing, and financial support can be an important thing. So if you're running for office in Japan, well, one, you might be born into it, right? You might be from one of these political parties, but certainly if you're not, if you're, you know, an independent, not a party independent, but a factional independent, and you want support, then you might well be likely to join a faction, really, whether you want to or not, because it's just worth your while. It's a bit like joining a prison gang, right? I mean, you might not want to do it, but it might be worth your while, and you might be crazy not to do it, especially if you're getting some financial support from the more established big hitters within that faction. So it's something that's really quite peculiar about the LDP, and it can affect voting, and it can affect who ascends. And that also might be one of the reasons why political popularity outside of the party and in the electorate doesn't map perfectly onto who's in charge.
So I think you covered this a bit, but just if so, just let us know again then that the market reaction has been positive to this news. Is there, what's going to change as a result of who wins this election?
It depends who comes in, but the one thing that has definitely changed already is the degree of political uncertainty. So I know it seems strange that on the verge of a couple of meaningful elections, political uncertainty would go down. But I think that, with Suga having, before his announcement, having a support rate of less than 30%, I think it was 28% last time I looked, that injected a degree of political uncertainty. And there was a suggestion that at the next general election, which the LDP would inevitably have won, they would have lost seats, they would have had less power, they would have had to be in a more diluted coalition with the Kommetor party, they would have got less done. So it would have just been more politically dysfunctional. So I think that part of the reason for the move, and one of the things that has happened already, is that political confusion or risk has actually diminished a little bit, even though we don't know who the next PM is going to be. As strange as that seems. So that's already happened. Then after that, we're really talking about policy, and that is really quite difficult. I think the broad policies that we would say are because Conor has come from, at least most recently, a background of doing sort of root and branch analysis on where Japan is restrained by its red tape, how it could be doing so much more. I think there is definitely a hope that a Kono prime ministership would increase the pace of, people talk about Japan's digital transformation, really just bringing Japan, which in some ways is extremely modern, but in other ways is extremely old fashioned, bringing Japan into the 21st century and making it a much more modern corporate sector, and also government sector, of course. So I think that's the expectation with Connor, is that you get meaningful structural reform. I mean, just to go off on a little bit of a tangent, I did a webinar with Connor back, I think it was December of last year, and he was talking to foreign investors, and everybody was lapping it up because he speaks perfect English, he's pretty charismatic, and seems to sort of talk a lot of sense. And he was talking about various different ways in which Japan is restrained, like they want to increase agricultural exports multiple times over, but at the same time they, by which I mean the Japanese government, haven't issued a new sake brewing license for many decades. And the reason for that is because there are vested interests within the lobby and within government to make sure that the incumbent sake brewers don't have young upstarts trying to get into that market. But equally, if you look overseas, if you look at the Scottish malt whiskey market, if you look at the craft beer market that came out of the US and is now enormous everywhere around the world, what you're seeing there is commercial opportunity and a massive amount of sales and economic growth because of new thinking in pretty old sectors. Imagine what would happen if there were new artisan and interesting sake brewers in Japan. Global markets would lap that up. They'd love it. The scope for selling that kind of stuff overseas is exactly what the government should be looking for. And Taro Kono, when we spoke to him about it, was kind of scratching his head as to why that was the case. Why Japan was handicapping itself in that way. So the hope with Kono is that Japan will cease to handicap itself. With Kishida, I think it's a little bit different. I think with Kishida, you know, because he's been talking just a lot more about spending money, I think it's much more the old argument of stimulus, of economic stimulus. And it may well be true that, Kishida would put together various packages that will be larger than the other people that are in line for this. I'm less excited about that. I'll be honest, I'm less excited about that. I just think that the multiple that you would put on that as an investor would be lower. Yeah. I don't think it will be getting to the bottom of the problem. The final thing that I'll just say about Takeuchi is that I worry a bit in a world where I think geopolitics and strategic issues are becoming much more important. The position of Japan between the US and China is a contentious one. Which way do they go? How do they maximize economic opportunity with China and also the US, but at the same time remain politically affiliated with the US and essentially ultimately rely on the US, you know, for existential military support should it come down to it? Although actually the US has pulled out of Afghanistan has sort of raised that question for various different countries around the world, or, you know, whether that can be relied upon. But either way, relations with China are going to be really, really important. Abe's relationship with China was terrible, but that's because, you know, he came from a family of, I don't want to say family of war criminals, but there were convicted war criminals in his direct lineage for what they had done in Manchuria. So in the 30s. So you know, there was a real sort of anti-Japanese stink around Abe in China. And the good thing about Suga, or at least maybe the only good thing about Suga, was he didn't have quite so much of that. And the other guys that we've mentioned, Kishida and Kono, wouldn't have quite so much of that. Takeuchi might well have quite a lot of that because she's seen as Abe's stalking horse, really, and is a nationalist. So I worry a bit about Takeuchi. Should she, you know, should she have the fortune to make it the international collaboration and all of those things with China might be imperiled.
Okay, and so I mean, this is all fascinating stuff. Obviously, you're very well versed in it. I suppose you know, an obvious question, I guess, is this of sort of amateur pleasure for you, or is it something that that is really material for your investment strategy?
Yeah, this is the paradox, isn't it? Because I like Japanese politics. I'm really interested in it. I like talking about it. But you're right. It's not as big a deal for, I don't think it's as big a deal for the market as people think. I mean, certainly on a short-term basis, it has been. And people will point to Abenomics as a period in which, you know, the market was considerably moved by, you know, I think people presume the personnel of government. Actually, I think that's wrong. I think that's wrong. I think that's overweighted. I think that there are lots and lots of other things which are either endogenous in Japan. So things like the, you know, the demographic situation in Japan and the myriad impacts that has on consumption, on commercial opportunities, on the tightness of the labor market and what that does for profitability, etc. It improves it, by the way. You know, things like that and exogenous stuff. So things like, yeah, those relationships with China and the US, you know, what monetary conditions are like around the world, not just in Japan, but other monetary policymakers, you know, that frankly, Japan and the Japanese Prime Minister will have absolutely nothing to do with. Some of them, you know, are somewhat political. You know, that relationship with China, for example, as I've just been saying, is, you know, can be linked to who's in the top job in Japan, but there are lots and lots of other things that we as fund managers have got to bear in mind, and that's even without just considering that the most important things for all of the companies that we own, and we are owning pieces of companies for our clients, is actually just what's going on within those companies, right? What's going on within those boardrooms, never mind what's going on in the cabinet. So it's not unimportant. It does create a background, and it is something that is worth us thinking about, and it gives sort of upside and downside scenarios and all of that kind of stuff. but it's never the most important thing. So when we're selecting stocks, it might well be, you know, the prevailing political situation might well be a gentle tailwind or a sort of barely perceptible headwind. We might consider it, but it's never the most important thing. And we're certainly not turning the portfolio around on any of this sort of political pontificating that I'm doing now, because I just think that would be really dangerous.
So it's been really interesting, but I mean, just before we do let you go, then what are the kind of big issues that matter a lot for your portfolio, whether it's stock specific or anything else?
Yeah, I think there are short term issues and there are mid to longer term issues. So I think short term issues, you know, it will be very interesting to see how Japan performs and what happens in the stock market when Japan is allowed to open up a little bit. What we see is that actual consumer appetite is running considerably ahead of consumption. So we're in a position where Japanese people want to go out and spend and they haven't been able to. Japan, because of the sluggish first rollout or early rollout of vaccines, you know, it's just behind the UK, Europe, the US in its recovery. So what happens when that happens in a full throttle way? That'll be interesting. We have a couple of positions which are exposed to that. These are businesses that we would want to own anyway, but I think are going to have a tailwind. So we've got a position in a company called Nomura Corp. So it's not Nomura the broker, but it's a design and fit out company. Essentially, they do displays and designs for shops, hotels, museums, civic attractions, things like that. They're exactly the kind of stuff that is being absolutely smoked by COVID and people's inability to go out and spend money and time in the way that they were before. So I think that they will do, you know, I think that they will do pretty well, but we do have to wait and see. Well, we don't have a lot of exposure to the retail sector, but where we do, you know, we've got a position in Don Quixote, which is a discount store and is kind of in the middle of it had an early COVID boom because people were staying at home and they were buying lots of essentials and stuff like that. And that has now ebbed away and there's a bit of a vacuum that has stopped. But the next big exciting thing for them will be when foreigners come back to Japan and you get an influx of particularly actually Asian foreigners. So Chinese, Koreans, et cetera, coming back and spending lots of money in Japan. So it'd be interesting to see how stocks like that perform. So that I think will be interesting, but that's pretty short term. That's pretty short term, and people shouldn't presume that we're charging into lots of these different things in the expectation of reopening. But where they exist within our portfolio, I think that should be beneficial. The other thing, which is on a more mid to longer term basis, it really goes back to what I was saying before about Japan dragging itself into the 21st century. And there are lots of ways that we see this in the portfolio. Actually, some of them are quite old school businesses. So we've got a position in a company, NEC, which, you know, everybody knows because of the computers and the monitors and stuff like that, the hardware sort of stuff. But this is a business which has been tasked really with the digitization of government, but also considerably also the corporate sector. So bringing Japan into the current century. It's also a company which is exporting technology that makes it cheaper for telecom carriers to roll out 5G networks. And crucially, it's not Chinese, right? It's not Huawei. So it can do that in a political and security conscious way for other global companies. In other global markets. So I think, you know, if you do see, particularly if you do see Connor taking the Prime Minister's seat and supercharging this digital transformation, which is already going on in Japan and will go on no matter who's in the hot seat, you know, I think they'll do particularly well. But I think stuff like that is going to be important. But also just, you know, changing tastes, you know, changing the way that the people are behaving. You know, we've got a position in a company called Wealth Navi. You know, that's a robo advisor. It's Japan's leading robo advisor. And the way that people manage their wealth in Japan is really, really old fashioned. So spotting these different areas of sort of anachronism in Japan, where you're getting hugely old fashioned behaviors, whether they're at the government or whether they're in the corporate sector, or whether they're in the consumer sector, and seeing how they're going to be brought up to date, I think that is the really big investment theme in Japan, and it should roll out for years rather than months, that one.
Okay. Well, that's a good positive note to end on. Dan, thanks so much for taking us through that. Really, really interesting dig into Japanese politics and a bit on the Japanese market as well. And thanks to all of our listeners for joining us. Hopefully, you've found this a good return of the Bruin podcast, and hopefully you'll be joining us again for the very next edition.